Chapter 8, October 1942. Bad days. Alvin appeared at our house the next night, driving a brand new green Buick with a fiancée named Minna Shap. Fiancée always got me when I heard the word spoken as a kid. It made whoever she was sound like somebody special. Then she showed up, and she was just some girl who, when she met the family, was afraid to say the wrong thing. The special one here wasn't the intended wife anyway, but the intended father-in-law, a masterful deal-maker prepared to deliver Alvin from the game machine business, where, assisted by two strong-armed thugs who lifted the freight and fended off evildoers, my cousin was employed trucking and setting up the illegal machines, and into a hand-tailored Hong Kong silk suit and a white-on-white monogram shirt as an Atlantic City restaurateur. Though Mr. Shap had himself started out in the 20s as Pinball Billy Shapiro, a two-bit hustler associated with the worst hoods from the most run-down row houses on the most violent streets of the South Philly Badlands, among them the uncle of Shushy Margulis, by 1942, the return on the pinballs and the slots amounted to upward of $15,000 unreported dollars each week. And Pinball Billy had been regenerated as William F. Shap II, highly esteemed member of the Green Valley Country Club of the Jewish fraternal organization Brit Achim, where on Saturday nights he took his dynamic wife and her gigantic jewels to dance to the music of Jackie Jacobs and his Jolly Jazzes and of Har Zion Synagogue, through whose burial society he purchased a family plot in a beautifully landscaped corner of the synagogue cemetery, as well as the Maharaja of an 18-room mansion in suburban Marion, and wintertime occupant of a poor boy's dream of a penthouse suite annually reserved for him at the Miami Beach Eden Rock. At 31, Minna was 8 years Alvin's senior, a buttery-complexioned woman with a brow-beaten look who, when she even dared to speak in her babyish voice, enunciated each word as though she had only just learned to tell time. She was every inch the child of overbearing parents, but because her father owned, in addition to the Intercity Carding Company, the public face of the gaming machine operation, half an acre of Lobster House, across from the steel pier where people lined up twice around the block to get in on weekends, and because back in the early 30s, when Prohibition ended and Pinball Billy's lucrative side interest in Waxy Gordon's interstate bootlegging syndicate suddenly dried up, he'd established Philadelphia's original Shaps, the steakhouse popular with one in Philly they called the Jew Mob. Pinball Billy figured strongly with Alvin as Minna's advocate. "The contract goes like this," Shap told him when he handed Alvin the cash to buy his daughter's engagement ring. "Minna takes care of your leg, you take care of Minna, and I take care of you." That's how my cousin came to don the hand-tailored suits and to arrogate to himself the glamorous responsibility for ushering to their table's big-name customers, such as Jersey City's crooked mayor Frank Haig, New Jersey's light heavyweight champion Gus Lesnovich, and the racket tycoons like Cleveland's Mo Dalitz, Boston's King Solomon, LA's Mickey Cohen, and even the brain himself, Meyer Lansky, when they were in town for a gangland convention. And regularly, every September, to welcome fresh from her pageant triumph, the newly crowned Miss America with all her befuddled relatives in tow. Once everyone was lavishly complimented and into their silly lobster bibs, it was Alvin's pleasure to signal to the waiter by a snap of his fingers that the house would pick up the tab. Pinball Billy's one-legged son-in-law soon gained a nickname of his own, Showy, bestowed on him, as Alvin told everyone, by Ali Stoltz, the contender for the world lightweight title. Alvin was up from Philly to visit with Stoltz, like Gus Lesnovich, a Newark boy, the day he and Minna wound up at our house for dinner. Stoltz had fought and lost a 15-round decision against the lightweight champion of Madison Square Garden the previous May and was training that fall at Marcillo's Market Street Gym for a November fight against Bo Jack that would gain him a shot at Tippy Larkin if he won. "Once Ali gets past Bo Jack," Alvin said, "there's just Larkin between him and the title, and Larkin's got a glass jaw." Glass jaw. Phony baloney. Going over. A hard guy. What's his beef? I'll take the grunt. The oldest dodge in the world. Alvin had a new vocabulary, and a whole new ostentatious way of talking that it clearly pained my parents to hear. Yet when he said adoringly of Stoltz's generosity, "Allie's a guy who is rapid with the dollar," I couldn't wait to sound like a hard guy myself by repeating the amazing expression at school along with the extensive medley of slang that Alvin now used just for the word money. Minna was silent during the meal, though my mother tried mightily to draw her out. I was overcome by shyness, and my father could think of nothing but the synagogue bombing that had taken place in Cincinnati the previous night and the looting of Jewish-owned stores in American cities scattered across two time zones. This was the second night in a row that he walked out on Uncle Monty rather than leave the family alone on Summit Avenue. But he couldn't worry about his brother's wrath at a time like this, and instead, all through dinner, kept getting up to go into the living room to turn on the radio and hear what news there was in the aftermath of the Winchell funeral. Alvin, meanwhile, was able to talk only about Allie and his quest for the world boxing crown as though the lightweight contender native to Newark embodied Alvin's profoundest conception of the human race. Could the abandonment have been any more complete of the moral code that had cost him his leg? He had disposed of whatever once stood between him and the aspirations of a Shushy Margulis. He had disposed of us. I wondered when I met her if Alvin had even told Minna that he was an amputee. It didn't occur to me that her subjugated personality was precisely what made her the first and only woman Alvin could tell. Nor did I understand that Minna was the evidence of his incapacity with women. His stump, in fact, constituted Alvin's greatest success with Minna, particularly after Shap died in 1960 and Minna's worthless brother took over the slots, while Alvin was content just to acquire the restaurants and to begin running with the best-looking hookers in two states. Whenever the stump cracked and got sore and bloody and infected, which it did as a result of his many follies, Minna immediately stepped in and wouldn't allow him to wear his prosthesis. Alvin would say to her, "For Christ's sakes, don't worry about it. It will be all right." But here alone, Minna prevailed. "You can't put a load on that leg," she'd tell him, "till you get it fixed." Meaning the artificial leg, which was always, in the leg maker's phrase that Alvin had taught to me back when I, not yet nine, was the mothering Minna, losing its fit. When Alvin got older and his stump broke down all the time from bearing all the weight he'd gained, when he had to be without the prosthesis for weeks on end until it healed, Minna would drive him to the public beach in the summertime and watch fully clothed from under a big umbrella while he played for hours in the all-healing surf, bobbing in the waves and floating on his back and spouting saltwater geysers into the air and then to throw a scare into the tourists crowding the beach, emerging from the water screaming, "Shark! Shark!" while pointing in horror at his stump. Alvin showed up with Minna for dinner after phoning that morning to tell my mother that he was going to be in North Jersey and wanted to stop by to thank his aunt and uncle for all they had done for him when he'd come home from the commandos and given everyone a hard time. He had a lot to be grateful for, he said, and he wanted to make peace with the two of them and to see the two boys and to introduce his fiancée. That's what he said, and that may even have been what he had in mind before he came face to face with my father and the memory of my father's reforming instincts, and the fact of their innate antipathy. The antipathy as human types that were really there from the start. And it was why, when I got home from school and heard the news, I dug down into my drawer and found his medal and, for the first time since he left for Philly, pinned it back on my undershirt. Of course, it was hardly an ideal day for a conciliatory visit from the family's black sheep. There'd been no anti-Semitic violence reported in Newark or in the other major New Jersey cities during the night, but the firebombing of the synagogue, that subsequently burned to the ground, some 100 miles up the Ohio River from Louisville in Cincinnati, and the random window smashing and looting of Jewish-owned stores in eight other cities, St. Louis, Buffalo, and Pittsburgh, the three largest, did nothing to diminish fear that the spectacle of Walter Winchell's Jewish funeral just across the Hudson in New York, and the demonstrations and counter-demonstrations coinciding with all the solemn observances, could easily provoke an outbreak of violence a lot closer to home. At school, first thing in the morning, a special half-hour assembly program had been called for grades 4 through 8. Along with a representative from the Board of Education, a deputy from Mayor Murphy's office, and the current president of the PTA, the principal spelled out the measures being taken to ensure our safety during the day and offered 10 rules that would protect us from harm on our way to and from school. While no mention was made of Bullet Applebaum's Jewish police, who'd been on the street all night long and was still there in the morning, drinking hot coffee out of thermoses and eating powdered donuts donated by Leroff's bakery when Sandy and I started off for school, we were assured by the mayor's deputy that, until normal conditions are restored, extra details of city police would be patrolling the neighborhood, and we were instructed not to be alarmed if we found a uniformed policeman stationed at each of the school doors and a policeman in the corridors. Two mimeograph sheets were then distributed to every pupil. One, listing the rules to obey on the street, which our teachers would go over with us when we returned to our homerooms, and the other, to take to our parents to advise them of the new safety procedures. If there were questions, our parents should direct them to Mrs. Sisselman, the PTA president who'd succeeded my mother. We ate in the dining room, where we last had a meal when Aunt Evelyn had brought Rabbi Bengelsdorf to meet us. After Alvin's call, my mother, whose inability to hold a personal grudge Alvin would have known he could count on the moment he heard her answer the phone, went off to buy food for a dinner that would especially please him. And this, despite the anxiety aroused in her each time she had to unlock the door and go back out on the street. That armed Newark cops were now walking the beat and cruising the local streets in squad cars gave her only slightly more assurance than did the glimpses of Bullet Applebaum's Jewish police. And so, like anyone else shopping in a city under siege, she wound up all but running back and forth to Chancellor Avenue to pick up everything she needed. In the kitchen, she proceeded to bake the chocolate layer cake with chocolate icing and chopped walnuts that had been Alvin's favorite, and to peel the potatoes and chop the onions for the latkes that Alvin could devour by the batch. And the house still smelled of the baking and frying and broiling that had been touched off by the unexpected homecoming when Alvin drove his new Buick into the alleyway. There, where we'd run pass plays together with the football I stole, Alvin pulled up behind the little Ford pickup that Mr. Kakuzi used to move people's furniture as a second job, and that happened to be parked in the garage because it was the night watchman's day off. And on his day off, he slept round the clock. Alvin arrived wearing a pearl-gray sharkskin suit, padded heavily at the shoulders, perforated two-tone wingtip shoes with taps on the toes, and bearing gifts for all. Aunt Bess's was a white apron decorated with red roses. Sandy's, a sketch pad. Mine, a Phillies cap. And Uncle Herman's, a certificate entitling a family of four to a free lobster dinner at the Atlantic City restaurant. His giving us all presents reassured me that just because he'd run off to Philadelphia, he hadn't forgotten all the good stuff he'd found in our house in the years preceding his losing his leg. It certainly did not look then and there as though we were a divided family. Or that when dinner was over, and Minna already in the kitchen taking a lesson in latke making from her new aunt, a battle royale could possibly break out between my father and Alvin. Perhaps, if Alvin hadn't shown up in his flashy clothes and his snazzy car, all but seething with the raw carnality of Marcillo's gym and exuberant with the imminent acquisition of undreamed-of wealth, perhaps, if Winchell hadn't been assassinated 24 hours earlier and the worst that had been feared when Lindbergh first took office hadn't seemed closer to befalling us than ever before, perhaps then the two grown men who mattered most to me throughout my childhood might never have come so close to murdering each other. Before that night, I had no idea my father was so well suited for wreaking havoc, or equipped to make that lightning-quick transformation from sanity to lunacy that is indispensable in enacting the unbridled urge to destroy. Unlike Uncle Monty, he preferred never to speak of the ordeal of a Jewish tenement kid on Runyon Street before World War I, when the Irish, armed with sticks and rocks and iron pipes, regularly came streaming up through the viaduct underpasses of the ironbound section, seeking vengeance against the Christ killers of the Jewish Third Ward. And much as he enjoyed taking Sandy and me to Laurel Garden on Springfield Avenue when tickets to a good match came his way, men fighting each other outside a boxing ring appalled him. That he'd always had a muscular physique I knew from a snapshot taken when he was 18 and pasted by my mother into the family photo album alongside the only other photograph surviving from his youth, a picture of him at the age of 6 standing next to Uncle Monty, 3 years older and close to a foot and a half taller, two ragtag kids stiffly posing in their ancient overalls and their dirty shirts and with their caps pushed back just far enough to reveal the cruelty of their haircuts. In that sepia photo of him at 18, he's already a million miles from childhood, a full-fledged force of nature, standing cross-armed in his bathing suit on the sunny beach at Spring Lake, New Jersey, the immovable keystone at the base of a human pyramid of six raffish hotel waiters enjoying their afternoon off. As evidenced in that 1919 photo, he'd been powerful through the chest right from the start, and the yoke-bearing shoulders and brawny arms that he had somehow retained even through his years knocking on doors for metropolitan life, so that now at 41, after having worked hauling heavy crates and lifting 100-pound sacks 6 nights a week all through September, there was probably more explosive strength stored up in that body than ever before in his life. Prior to that night, it would have been as impossible for me to envision him beating somebody up, let alone battering bloody his beloved older brother's fatherless son, as to imagine him atop my mother, especially as there was no taboo stronger among Jews with our impoverished European origins and our tenaciously held American ambitions than the pervasive, unwritten prohibition against settling disputes by force. In that era, the common Jewish propensity was by and large nonviolent as well as non-alcoholic, a virtue whose shortcoming was the failure to educate the bulk of the young of my generation in the combative aggression that was the first law of other ethnic educations and indisputably of great practical value when you couldn't negotiate your way out of violence or manage to run away. Among, say, the several hundred boys in my elementary school between the ages of 5 and 14 who were not chromosomally preordained to be top-flight lightweights like Ali Stoltz or successful racketeers like Longies Willman, surely far fewer fistfights broke out than in any of the other neighborhood schools in industrial Newark, where the ethical obligations of a child were differently defined and schoolmates demonstrated their belligerence by means not readily available to us. So then, for every reason imaginable, it was a devastating night. I didn't have the capacity in 1942 to begin to decipher all the awful implications, but just the sight of my father's and Alvin's blood was stunning enough. Blood spattered the length and breadth of our imitation Oriental rug. Blood dripping from the splintered remains of our coffee table. Blood smeared like a sign across my father's forehead. Blood spurting from my cousin's nose, and the two of them not so much fist fighting, not so much wrestling as caroming, with a terrible bony thwack colliding, rearing back and charging in like men with antlers branching from their brows, fantastical cross-species creatures sprung from mythology into our living room and pulping each other's flesh with their massive, snaggle-toothed horns. Inside a house, you usually scale down your movements. You scale down your speed, but here, the scale of things was reversed and terrifying to behold. The South Boston riots, the Detroit riots, the Louisville assassination, the Cincinnati firebombing, the mayhem in St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Buffalo, Akron, Youngstown, Peoria, Scranton, Syracuse, and now this? In an ordinary family living room? Traditionally the staging area for the collective effort to hold the line against the intrusions of a hostile world? The anti-Semites were about to be abetted in their exhilarating solution to America's worst problem by our taking up the cudgels and hysterically destroying ourselves. The horror ended with Mr. Kakuza in his nightshirt and his nightcap, attire I'd never before seen on anyone, man or boy, other than in a funny movie, crashing into our flat with his pistol drawn. A frantic wail rose from Joey's old-world grandmother, appropriately swathed like the Calabrian Queen of the Shades at the foot of our landing, and from within our own flat came a noise equally hair-raising, the instant the splintered back door flew open and my mother saw that the night-shirted intruder was armed. Minna began bringing up into her hands everything she'd just swallowed at dinner. I couldn't help myself and promptly urinated, while Sandy, who alone among us was able to find the right words and the vocal strength to utter them, cried, "Don't shoot! It's Alvin!" But Mr. Kakuza was a professional guardian of private property, trained to act now and draw distinctions later, and, without pausing to ask, "Who's Alvin?" immobilized my father's assailant in a strangulating half-Nelson with one arm, while holding the pistol to his head with the hand of the other. Alvin's prosthesis had cracked in two. His stump was torn to shreds, and one of his wrists was broken. Three of my father's front teeth were shattered, two ribs were fractured, a gash was opened along his right cheekbone that had to be sutured with almost twice as many stitches as were needed to close the wound inflicted on me by the orphanage horse, and his neck was so badly wrenched that he had to go around in a high steel collar for months afterward. The glass-topped coffee table with the dark mahogany frame that my mother had saved over the years to buy at BAM's, and where, at the conclusion of a pleasant hour of evening reading, she would set down, with its ripping bookmark in place, the new novel by Pearl Buck or Fanny Hurst or Edna Ferber, borrowed from the local pharmacy's tiny rental library, lay in fragments all across the room, and microscopic crumbs of glass were embedded in my father's hands. The rug, the walls, and the furniture were speckled with chocolate icing from the slices of layer cake they had been eating when they sat down over dessert to talk together in the living room, as well as with their blood, and then there was the smell of it, the airless, gag-inducing slaughterhouse smell. It's so heartbreaking, violence, when it's in a house, like seeing the clothes in a tree after an explosion. You may be prepared to see death, but not the clothes in the tree. And all of it, the result of my father's failing to understand that Alvin's nature was never really reformable. Despite the lecturing and the hectoring love, all of it the result of having taken him in to save him from what it was simply in his nature to become. All of it the result of my father's looking Alvin over and remembering the tragically evanescent life of Alvin's late father and, in his despair, sadly shaking his head and saying, "A Buick automobile, a Sharpie's clothes, the scum of the earth for your friends, but do you know, do you care, does it bother you at all, Alvin, what's happening in this country tonight? It did years ago, damn it. I can remember clear as day when it did, but now, no. Now it's big cigars and motor cars, but do you have any idea at all what is happening to the Jews even while we sit here?" And Alvin, whose lot had finally come to something, whose prospects never before had been so hopeful, could not bear and would not endure being informed by the custodian whose tutelage had once meant everything, by the relative who, when no one else would have him, had twice taken him to live in a homey little weequake flat amid a kindly family and their benign concerns, that he had come to nothing. His voice, husky with the grievance of the injured party, his delivery staccato and without a single caesura to let anything in that wasn't retaliatory, all calumny, all castigation, all coercion and fatuous bluff, Alvin shouted at my father, "The Jews? I wrecked my life for the Jews. I lost my fucking leg for the Jews. I lost my fucking leg for you. Why did I give a shit either way about Lindbergh? But you send me to go fucking fight him, and the stupid fucking kid I am, I go? And look, look, Uncle fucking disaster, I have no fucking leg." Here, he hiked up a handful of the pearl gray fabric in which he was so lustrously clad to reveal where there was indeed no longer a lower limb of flesh and blood and muscle and bone. And then, insulted, negated inwardly once again the unmanned man and the bum kid, he added his final heroic touch by spitting into my father's face. A family, my father liked to say, is both peace and war. But this was family war as I could never have imagined it. Spitting into my father's face the way he'd spit into the face of that dead German soldier. If only he had been allowed to go along unrehabilitated on his own stinking trajectory, but that hadn't happened. And so this was how the great menace undid us and the abomination of violence entered our house. And I saw how bitterness blinds a man and the defilement it spawns. And why? Why did he go to fight in the first place? Why did he fight and why did he fall? Because there is a war going on. He chooses that way. The raging, rebellious instinct historically trapped. If only the times were different. If only he had been smarter. But he wants to fight. He's like the very fathers he wants to be rid of. That's the tyranny of the problem. trying to be faithful to what he's trying to be rid of. Trying to be faithful and to get rid of what he's faithful to at the same time. And that's why he went to fight in the first place. Later that night, after a pair of Alvin's buddies had pulled up in a caddy with Pennsylvania plates, one of them to get Alvin and Minna over to Ali Stolz's doctor's office on Elizabeth Avenue, the other to drive their Buick back to Philly, after my father was home from the Beth Israel emergency room, where they'd plucked the glass out of his hands and stitched up his face and x-rayed his neck and taped his ribcage and, on his way out, handed him codeine tablets to take for the pain. After Mr. Kakuza, who'd rushed my father to the hospital in his pickup, had returned him safely to the befouled and littered battlefield that was now our flat, the gunshots erupted on Chancellor Avenue. Shots, screaming, shouting, sirens. The pogrom had begun, and it was only seconds before Mr. Kakuza charged back up the stairs he'd only just descended and banged once on our broken back door before rushing in. Desperate for sleep, I was dragged from bed by my brother, but when my legs wouldn't work and kept collapsing from uncontrollable fear, I had to be carried off in his arms by my father. My mother, who instead of going to bed and trying to sleep, had donned her apron and a pair of rubber gloves and set about to purge the house of its filth with a bucket and a broom and a mop. My meticulous mother, weeping amid the wreckage of her living room, was guided to the door by Mr. Kakuza, and the four of us were herded down the stairs and into the Wishnow's old flat to take cover there. This time, when Mr. Kakuza offered a pistol, my father accepted it. His poor human body was black and blue and bandaged just about everywhere. His mouth was full of broken teeth, and still he sat with us on the floor in the Kakuza's windowless back foyer, regarding the weapon in his hands with all his concentration, as though it were no longer just a weapon, but the most serious thing entrusted to him since he'd first been given his infant babies to hold. My mother sat straight up between Sandy's self-conscious stoicism and my stupefied inertness, gripping us each by the arm closest to her and doing all she could to keep a thin layer of courage from revealing her terror to the children. Meanwhile, the biggest man I'd ever seen moved with a pistol through the darkened flat, stealthily advancing from window to window to ascertain with the eagle-eyed thoroughness of the veteran night watchman whether anyone lurked anywhere nearby with an axe, a gun, a rope, or a can of kerosene. Joey, his mother, and his grandmother had been directed by Mr. Kakuza to remain in their beds, though the old lady could not resist the magnetism of all that turbulence and the picture we four presented of sheer plight. Snarling in tiny bursts of raw Italian that could not have been complimentary to her guests, she peered out from the doorway of the dark kitchen where she customarily slept in her clothes on a cot next to the stove, fixing us in the crosshairs of her madness, because mad she was, as if she were the patron saint of anti-Semitism whose silver crucifix had engendered it all. The firing went on for less than an hour, but we didn't head back upstairs until dawn, and didn't learn until after Mr. Kakuza bravely ventured forth as a scout to where Chancellor Avenue was cordoned off, that the gun battle had been not between the city police and the anti-Semites, but between the city police and the Jewish police. There had been no pogrom in Newark that night, just a shootout. Extraordinary for having occurred within earshot of our house, but otherwise not much different from the disorder that could erupt in any large city after dark. And though three Jews had been killed, Duke Glick, Big Jerry, and Bullet himself, it wasn't necessarily because they were Jews. Though it didn't hurt, my Uncle Monty said, but because they were exactly the sort of thugs that the new mayor wanted off the streets, primarily to signal to Longy that he was no longer an honorary member of the city's Board of Commissioners, a position he was rumored by Meyer Ellenstein's enemies to have held under Murphy's Jewish predecessor. Nobody bothered taking the police commissioner too seriously when he explained to the Newark News that it was the trigger-happy vigilantes who, without provocation, had opened fire a little before midnight on two foot patrolmen walking their beat. Nor, among our neighbors, was there any noticeable expression of grief because of how the three, dangerous people in their own right, whose protection nobody decent would have dreamed of requesting, had been unceremoniously mowed down. Of course, it was awful that the blood of violent men should stain the pavement where the neighborhood children wended their way to school every day, but at least it wasn't blood shed in a clash with the Klan or the Silver Shirts or the Bund. No pogrom, and yet at 7 that morning, my father was on the phone long distance to Winnipeg to admit to Shepsie Terschwell that the Jews were so frightened and that the anti-Semites so emboldened that it was no longer possible in Newark, where fortunately the prestige of Rabbi Prince had continued to exert an influence over the powers that be, and nothing worse than relocation had as yet been forced on a single Jewish family to live as normal people. Whether outright government-sanctioned persecution was inevitable, nobody could say for sure, but the fear of persecution was such that not even a practical man, grounded in his everyday tasks, a person who tried his best to contain the uncertainty and the anxiety and the anger and operate according to the dictates of reason, could hope to preserve his equilibrium any longer. Yes, my father admitted, he had been wrong all along, and Bess and the Terschwells had been right. And then, as best he could, he shook off his abashment over everything he'd mismanaged and badly misjudged, including the improbable violence that had smashed to bits, along with our coffee table, that lifelong barrier of rigid rectitude that had stood between his harsh upbringing and his mature ideals. "That's it," he told Shepsie Terschwell. "I can't live any longer not knowing what will happen tomorrow." And their phone conversation moved on to emigration and the steps to be taken and the arrangements to be made, so that by the time Sandy and I left the house, there was no misunderstanding that, quite incredibly, we'd been overpowered by the forces arrayed against us and were about to flee and become foreigners. I wept all the way to school. Our incomparable American childhood was ended. Soon, my homeland would be nothing more than my birthplace. Even Selden in Kentucky was better off now. But then, it was over. The nightmare was over. Lindbergh was gone, and we were safe, though never would I be able to revive that unfazed sense of security first fostered in a little child by a big, protective republic and his ferociously responsible parents. Drawn from the archives of Newark's Newsreel Theater. Tuesday, October 6, 1942. 30,000 mourners streamed through the Great Hall of Pennsylvania Station to view Walter Winchell's flag-draped coffin. The turnout exceeds even the expectations of New York Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, whose decision it was to transform the assassination into the occasion for a citywide day of mourning for American victims of Nazi violence, culminating in a funeral oration to be delivered by FDR. Outside the station, as at numerous other locations throughout the city, silent men and women dressed in somber clothing distribute half-dollar-sized black buttons whose white lettering poses the question, "Where is Lindbergh?" Just before noon, Mayor LaGuardia arrives at the studio of the city radio station, where he removes his wide-brimmed black Stetson, a memento of his boyhood roots in the Arizona Territory as the son of a U.S. Army bandmaster, to recite the Lord's Prayer. Then he puts the hat back on to read aloud, in Hebrew, the Jewish prayer for the dead. At the stroke of noon, by decree of the city council, a minute of silence is observed in the five boroughs. The New York police are in evidence everywhere, chiefly to oversee the protest demonstrations organized by the array of right-wing organizations headquartered in preponderantly German Yorkville, the Manhattan neighborhood on the Far East Side that is the main headquarters for the American Nazi movement, and that militantly endorsed the president and his policies. At 1 p.m., an honor guard of motorcycles, manned by policemen wearing black armbands, aligns itself with the funeral cortege forming outside Penn Station and, with the mayor leading the way from a motorcycle sidecar, escorts the cortege slowly northward up 8th Avenue, eastward along 57th Street, northward again on 5th Avenue to 65th Street and Temple Emmanuel. There, among the dignitaries summoned by LaGuardia to fill the temple's every last seat, are the 10 members of Roosevelt's 1940 cabinet, Roosevelt's 4 Supreme Court appointees, President Philip Murray of the CIO, President William Green of the AFL, President John L. Lewis of the United Mine Workers, Roger Baldwin of the American Civil Liberties Union, as well as past and current Democratic governors, senators, and congressmen from New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut, among them the Democrats defeated 1928 presidential aspirant, former New York Governor Al Smith. Loudspeakers installed overnight by municipal laborers and wired to telephone poles and barber poles and door lintels throughout the city carry the memorial service to the New Yorkers who've assembled on the streets of every Manhattan neighborhood, except Yorkville, and to the thousands of out-of-towners who have congregated alongside them, all those Mr. and Mrs. Americas who'd been listening to Walter Winchell weekly since he first came on the air and who have journeyed to his hometown to pay their respects. And virtually every man, woman, and child among them wears that now ubiquitous badge of defiant solidarity, the black and white Where is Lindbergh button. Fiorello H. LaGuardia, the down-to-earth idol of the city's working people, the flamboyant ex-congressman who belligerently represented a congested East Harlem district of poor Italians and Jews for five terms, who as early as 1933 described Hitler as a perverted maniac and called for a boycott of German goods, the tenacious spokesman for the unions, the needy, and the unemployed, who battled almost single-handedly against Hoover's do-nothing congressional Republicans during the first dark year of the Depression, and to the dismay of his own party, called for taxation to soak the rich. The liberal, anti-Tammany reform Republican who has been the three-term fusion mayor of the country's most populous city, the metropolis that is home to the largest concentration of Jews in the hemisphere, LaGuardia is alone among the members of his party in displaying his contempt for Lindbergh and for the Nazi dogma of Aryan superiority that he, himself, the son of an unobservant Jewish mother from Austrian Trieste and a freethinker Italian father who came to America as a ship's musician, has identified as the precept at the heart of Lindbergh's credo and of the huge American cult that worships the president. LaGuardia stands beside the coffin and addresses the dignitaries with that same excitable, high-pitched voice in which he famously narrated the Sunday comic strips of the city's radio station to the city's children every Sunday morning during a New York newspaper strike. Like the best of uncles, proceeding patiently, panel by panel, balloon by balloon, from Dick Tracy to Little Orphan Annie and on through the rest of the serialized funnies. "We can dispense with the cant at the start," says the mayor. Everybody knows that Walter was not a lovely human being. Walter was not the strong, silent type who hides everything, but the muckraker who hates everything hidden. As anybody who ever turned up in his column can tell you, Walter was not always as accurate as he might have been. He was not shy, he was not modest, he was not decorous, discreet, kindly, etc. My friends, if I were to list for you everything lovely that WW was not, we'd be here till next Yom Kippur. I'm afraid that the late Walter Winchell was just one more doozy of a specimen of the imperfect man in declaring himself a candidate for the presidency of the United States. Were his motives pure as ivory soap? Walter Winchell's motives? Was his preposterous candidacy uncontaminated by a raving ego? My friends, only a Charles A. Lindbergh has motives pure as ivory soap when he runs for the American presidency. Only a Charles A. Lindbergh is decorous, discreet, etc. Oh, and accurate, too. Wholly accurate, always when every few months he summons up the gregariousness to address his 10 favorite platitudes to the nation. Only a Charles A. Lindbergh is a selfless ruler and a strong, silent saint. Walter, on the other hand, was Mr. Gossip Columnist. Walter, on the other hand, was Mr. Broadway. Like the ponies, like the late hours, like Sherman Billingsley. Somebody once told me that he even liked the girls. And the repeal of that noble experiment, as Mr. Herbert Hoover called it, the repeal of the hypocritical, expensive, stupid, unenforceable 18th Amendment was no more ignoble to Walter Winchell than it was to the rest of us here in New York. In short, Walter lacked every gleaming virtue demonstrated daily by the incorruptible test pilot ensconced in the White House. Oh yes, several more differences that are perhaps worth noting between fallible Walter and infallible Lindy. Our president is a fascist sympathizer, more than likely an outright fascist. And Walter Winchell, was the enemy of the fascist. Our president is no lover of Jews, and more than likely, a dyed-in-the-wool anti-Semite, while Walter Winchell was a Jew, and the unwavering vociferous enemy of the anti-Semite. Our president is an admirer of Adolf Hitler, and more than likely, a Nazi himself, and Walter Winchell was Hitler's first American enemy and his worst American enemy. There's where our imperfect Walter was incorruptible, where it mattered. Walter is too loud. Walter talks too fast. Walter says too much. And yet, by comparison, Walter's vulgarity is something great. And Lindbergh's decorum is hideous. Walter Winchell, my friends, was the enemy of Nazis everywhere, not excluding the Dices and the Bilbos and the Parnell Thomases who served their Führer in the United States Congress, not excluding the Hitlerites who write for the New York Journal American and the New York Daily News, not excluding those who royally fed Nazi murderers in our American White House at the taxpayers' expense. And it was because he was Hitler's enemy, and it was because he was the Nazis' enemy, that Walter Winchell was gunned down yesterday in the shadow of the statue of Thomas Jefferson in gracious old Louisville's most historic and beautiful public square. For speaking his mind in the state of Kentucky, W.W. was assassinated by the Nazis of America who, thanks to the silence of our strong, silent, selfless president, today run rampant throughout this great land. It can't happen here, my friends. It is happening here. And where is Lindbergh? Where is Lindbergh? Out in the streets, those listening together around the loudspeakers take up the mayor's cry, and soon their chant is cascading eerily across the entire city. Where is Lindbergh? Where is Lindbergh? While inside the synagogue, the mayor repeats and repeats his four irate syllables, angrily banging the pulpit, not like an orator theatrically emphasizing a point, but like an outraged citizen demanding the truth. Where is Lindbergh? This is the snarling peroration with which the red-faced LaGuardia readies the assembled mourners for the climactic appearance of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who stuns even his closest political cronies, Hopkins, Morgenthau, Frawley, Burl, Baruch, all sitting beheaded only feet from the coffin of the martyred candidate, whose brand of megalomania was never to the taste of the White House in a circle, however useful a mouthpiece he may have been to their boss. By ordaining as Winchell's successor the cunning, contemptuous, short-tempered, bull-headed, roly-poly politico standing 5 feet 2 inches tall and known affectionately to his devoted constituents as the Little Flower. From the pulpit of Temple Emanuel, the nominal head of the Democratic Party pledges his support to New York's mayor as a fusion candidate to oppose Lindbergh's quest for a second term in 1944. Wednesday, October 7th, 1942. Piloted by President Lindbergh, the Spirit of St. Louis departs from Long Island in the morning, lifting off from the runway that served as the point of embarkation for the transatlantic solo flight of May 20th, 1927. Without either a U.S. Air Corps or a Secret Service escort, the plane speeds through the cloudless autumn sky across New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and down to Kentucky. Only an hour before he is to set down in the midday sunshine at the Louisville Commercial Airport is the White House notified by the president of his destination. His timing allows just enough notice for Louisville Mayor Wilson Wyatt and the city and its citizens to prepare for the president's arrival. A mechanic is at the ready on the ground to check over the plane and tune and equip it for the return flight. Of Louisville's 320,000 residents, the police estimate that at least a third have made the 5-mile trek out from the city and are already packing the fields and the roads adjacent to Bowman Field when the president lands and smoothly taxis his plane to a platform where a microphone has been hooked up for him to address the vast crowd. When finally the great din of their greeting begins to diminish and his voice can be heard, the president makes no mention of Walter Winchell, does not allude to the assassination 2 days earlier, or to the funeral the day before, or to the speech made by Mayor LaGuardia on the occasion of his anointment as Winchell's successor by Franklin Roosevelt in a New York synagogue. He does not have to. That LaGuardia is, like Winchell before him, no more than a stalking horse for FDR in his dictatorial quest for an unprecedented third presidential term, and that those behind the vicious LaGuardia libel of our president are the very same people who would have forced America to go to war in 1940, have already been colorfully explained to the nation by Vice President Wheeler in an impromptu Washington speech before the American Legion Convention the previous evening. All that the president says to the crowd is, "Our country is at peace, our people are at work, our children are at school. I flew down here to remind you of that. Now I'm going back to Washington so as to keep things that way." An innocuous enough string of sentences, but to these tens of thousands of Kentuckians who've been the subject of national interest for two full days, it is as though he has announced the end of all hardship on earth. Pandemonium once again, while the president, as laconic as ever, and bidding farewell with just a single wave, squeezes his lanky frame back into the plane's cockpit, and from the airstrip a smiling mechanic signals with his wrench that everything's checked out and ready to go. The engine turns, the lone eagle waves a final goodbye, and with a rush and a roar, the Spirit of St. Louis lifts free of Daniel Boone's gorgeous wilderness state, inch by inch, foot by foot, until at last, like the barnstorming, skydiving, wing-walking stunt pilot he'd been as a kid, flying low over the farming towns of the West and to the delight of the delirious crowd, Lindy clears by no more than a hair's breadth the telephone wires strung from the poles along Route 58. Rising steadily into the stream of a warm, gentle tailwind, the most famous small plane in aviation history, the modern-day counterpart of Columbus's Santa Maria and the Pilgrim's Mayflower, disappears eastward, never to be seen again. Thursday, October 8th, 1942. Ground searches of the regular flight path between Louisville and Washington yield no evidence of wreckage despite the perfect fall weather that makes it possible for local search parties to penetrate deep into the rugged mountains of West Virginia and to range over the harvested farmlands of Maryland, and for state authorities to dispatch police launches up and down the Maryland and Delaware coastlines throughout the daylight hours. In the afternoon, the Army, Coast Guard, and Navy joined the search, along with hundreds of men and boys in every county from every state east of the Mississippi who have volunteered to assist the National Guard units called out by the state governors. Yet by dinner time in Washington, there is still no reported sighting of the plane or its wreckage, and so at 8 p.m., the cabinet is summoned to an emergency meeting at the vice president's home. There, Burton K. Wheeler announces that, after consulting with the First Lady and the majority leaders of the House and the Senate, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he has deemed it in the country's best interest to assume the duties of acting president in accordance with Article 2, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution. In dozens of newspapers, the evening headline, printed in the boldest, blackest type seen on America's front pages since the stock market crash of 1929, and intended to shame Fiorello LaGuardia, somberly reads, "Where is Lindbergh?" Friday, October 9th, 1942. By the time Americans awaken to begin their day, martial law has been imposed throughout the continental United States and in the territories and possessions. At noon, Acting President Wheeler travels under military guard to the Capitol, where he announces to an emergency closed-door session of Congress that the FBI has received information establishing that the president had been kidnapped and is being held by parties unknown at a location somewhere in North America. The acting president assures the Congress that all steps are being taken to secure the president's release and to bring the perpetrators of the crime to justice. In the meantime, the country's borders with Canada and Mexico have been sealed, airports and seaports have been shut down, and law and order, says the acting president, is to be maintained in the District of Columbia by the U.S. Armed Forces and elsewhere by the National Guard in cooperation with the FBI and local police authorities. Again. So reads the one-word headline carried on every Hearst paper in the country and printed above pictures of the little Lindbergh baby, last photographed alive in 1932, only days before his kidnapping at the age of 20 months. Saturday, October 10th, 1942. German state radio announces that the kidnapping of Charles A. Lindbergh, 33rd President of the United States and signatory to America's historic Iceland understanding with the Third Reich, has been discovered to have been perpetrated by a conspiracy of Jewish interests. Top-secret Wehrmacht intelligence data are cited to corroborate initial reports from the Ministry of State that the plot was masterminded by the warmonger Roosevelt in collusion with his Jewish Treasury Secretary Morgenthau, his Jewish Supreme Court Justice Frankfurter, and the Jewish investment banker Baruch, that it is being financed by the international Jewish usurers Warburg and Rothschild, and carried out under the command of Roosevelt's mongrel henchman, the half-Jew gangster LaGuardia, mayor of Jewish New York City, along with the powerful Jewish governor of New York State, the financier Lehman, in order to return Roosevelt to the White House and for the launching of an all-out Jewish war against the non-Jewish world. The intelligence data, which have been turned over to the American FBI by the German embassy in Washington, allege that the assassination of Walter Winchell was planned and executed by the same cabal of Roosevelt Jews, and responsibility for the crime, predictably attributed by them to Americans of German descent, so as to foster the vicious "Where is Lindbergh?" campaign, which in turn moved the president to take to the air and fly to the scene of the assassination to reassure the citizens of Louisville, Kentucky, who were justifiably fearful of organized Jewish retaliation. But there, according to the Wehrmacht reports, as the president addressed the crowd, an airport mechanic bribed by the Jewish conspiracy, who has himself vanished and is believed to have been murdered by order of LaGuardia, rendered the aircraft's radio inoperative. No sooner had the president taken off for Washington than he was unable to make contact with the ground or with other aircraft and had no choice but to capitulate when the Spirit of St. Louis was corralled by high-flying British fighter planes, which forced him to deviate from his course and to land some hours later at an airstrip secretly maintained by international Jewish interests across the Canadian border from Lehman State of New York. In America, the German announcement prompts Mayor LaGuardia to tell City Hall reporters, "Any American who can believe that Lollapalooza of a Nazi lie has sunk to the lowest possible level." Nonetheless, both the mayor and the governor are said by informed sources to have been interviewed at length by agents of the FBI, and Secretary of the Interior Ford is demanding that Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada, conduct an intensive search on Canadian soil for President Lindbergh and his captors. Acting President Wheeler is reported to be examining the German documentation with White House aides, but will make no comment about the allegations until the search for the president's plane has been completed. Navy destroyers, along with Coast Guard PT boats, are now looking for signs of an air crash as far north as Cape May, New Jersey, and as far south as Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, while ground units of the Army Marine Corps and National Guard continue to search in 20 states for clues to the missing plane's whereabouts. The National Guard units enforcing the nationwide curfew report no incidents of violence prompted by the president's disappearance. Under martial law, America remains calm, though the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan and the leader of the American Nazi Party have jointly called upon the acting president to implement extreme measures to protect America from a Jewish coup d'etat. Meanwhile, a committee of American Jewish clergymen led by Rabbi Stephen Wise of New York telegrams the First Lady expressing their deepest sympathy in her family's hour of need. Rabbi Lionel Bengelsdorf is seen entering the White House in the early evening, reportedly there at Mrs. Lindbergh's request to offer spiritual guidance to the family during what is now the third day of their vigil. The White House invitation to Rabbi Bengelsdorf is widely interpreted to indicate the First Lady's refusal to accept that Jewish interests have had anything to do with her husband's disappearance. Sunday, October 11th, 1942. At church services around the country, prayers are offered in behalf of the Lindbergh family. The three major radio networks cancel regularly scheduled programs to broadcast the services conducted at Washington's National Cathedral, where the First Lady and her children are in attendance, and for the remainder of the day and into the evening, programming is devoted exclusively to inspirational music. At 8 p.m., Acting President Wheeler addresses the nation, assuring his fellow Americans that he has no plans to abandon the search. He reports that at the invitation of the Canadian Prime Minister, representatives from American law enforcement agencies will assist the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in scouring the eastern half of the U.S.-Canada border and the southernmost counties of the easterly Canadian provinces. Having emerged as official spokesman for the First Lady, Rabbi Lionel Bengelsdorf tells a large group of reporters waiting on the White House portico that Mrs. Lindbergh urges the American people to ignore speculation emanating from any foreign government concerning the circumstances of her husband's disappearance. She would remind the public, the rabbi says, that in 1926, as an airmail pilot on the St. Louis-Chicago run, the president twice survived, without injury, crashes that demolished his aircraft, and that as of the moment, it is the First Lady's belief that the president will once again be found to have survived should there have been another crash. The First Lady remains unconvinced, says the rabbi, by the evidence of a kidnapping that has been presented to her by the acting president. When Rabbi Bengelsdorf is asked why Mrs. Lindbergh cannot speak for herself and why the press is being prevented from questioning her directly, he replies, "Let me remind you that this is not the first time in her 36 years that Mrs. Lindbergh has been required to deal with inquiries from the press while enduring the gravest of family crises. I would think that Americans are altogether willing to accept whatever arrangement the First Lady decides will best protect her and her children's privacy for however long the search continues." When he is asked if there is any truth to rumors that Mrs. Lindbergh is too distraught to make her own decisions and that it is Lionel Bengelsdorf who is reaching her decisions for her, the rabbi replies, "Anyone who observed the demeanor of the First Lady at the cathedral this morning is able to see for himself that she is wholly competent intellectually, in complete possession of all her faculties, and that despite the magnitude of the situation, neither her reason nor her judgment has been in any way impaired." Despite the rabbi's reassurances, stories go out over the wire services reporting on suspicions voiced by a highly placed government official, believed to be Secretary Ford, that the First Lady has become the captive of Rabbi Rasputin, the Jewish spokesman considered comparable in his influence over the president's wife to the lunatic Siberian peasant monk who insidiously controlled the minds of the Tsar and Tsarina of Russia and all but ruled the imperial palace in the days leading up to the Russian Revolution, and whose mad reign ended only when he was murdered by a conspiracy of patriotic Russian aristocrats. Monday, October 12th, 1942. The London morning papers report that British intelligence has forwarded to the FBI German-coded communications proving beyond a doubt that President Lindbergh is alive and in Berlin. British intelligence ascertains that on October 7th, in keeping with a long-standing plan conceived by Air Marshal Hermann Göring, the President of the United States succeeded in ditching the Spirit of St. Louis at predetermined coordinates in the Atlantic, approximately 300 miles east of Washington. There, he reconnoitered with a waiting German U-boat whose crew transferred him to a German naval vessel waiting off the coast of Portugal to take him to Italian-occupied Kotor in Montenegro on the Adriatic Sea. The wreckage of the president's plane was commandeered and taken on board by a German military freighter, where it was dismantled, crated, and transported to a Gestapo warehouse in Bremen. The president himself was flown from a Kotor airstrip to Germany in a camouflaged Luftwaffe plane, accompanied by Air Marshal Göring, and upon his arrival at a Luftwaffe airbase, was driven to Hitler's Berchtesgaden hideaway to confer with the Führer. Serbian resistance groups in Yugoslavia confirmed the British intelligence reports on the basis of information supplied by sources within the German-instituted Belgrade government of General Milan Nedic, whose interior ministry directed the naval operations at the port of Kotor. In New York, Mayor LaGuardia tells reporters, "If it is true that our president has voluntarily fled to Nazi Germany, if it is true that, since his taking the oath of office, he has been working from the White House as a Nazi agent, if it is true that our domestic and foreign policies have been dictated to the president by the Nazi regime that today tyrannizes the entire European continent, then I lack the words to describe a treason whose wickedness is without equal in human history. Despite the imposition of martial law and a nationwide curfew, and despite the presence of heavily armed National Guard troops patrolling the streets of every major American city, anti-Semitic riots begin just after sundown in Alabama, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, Missouri, Ohio, South Carolina, Tennessee, North Carolina, and Virginia, and continue throughout the night and into the early morning. Not until approximately 8 a.m. are federal troops, dispatched by Acting President Wheeler to support the National Guard units, able to quell these disturbances and to bring under control the worst of the fires the rioters have set. By then, 122 American citizens have lost their lives. Tuesday, October 13th, 1942. In a noontime radio address, Acting President Wheeler places responsibility for the riots on the British government and their warmongering American supporters. Having falsely disseminated the vilest charges that could possibly be leveled against a patriot of the stature of Charles A. Lindbergh, just what did these people expect from a nation already grieving over the disappearance of a beloved leader? To advance their own economic and racial interests, says the acting president, these people choose to try to the limit the conscience of a heartsick nation. And just what do they then expect will occur? I can report that order has been restored to our ravaged cities throughout the South and the Midwest, but at what cost to the equanimity of our nation? A statement from the president's wife is subsequently delivered by Rabbi Lionel Bengelsdorf. Once again, the First Lady counsels her countrymen to ignore all unverifiable hypotheses about her husband's disappearance emanating from foreign capitals, and she requests of the U.S. government the immediate termination of the week-long search for her husband's plane. The First Lady wishes to remind the country of the tragic plight of Amelia Earhart, the greatest of women aviators, who, following the lead of President Lindbergh, made her heralded solo flight across the Atlantic in 1932, only to disappear without a trace in 1937 while attempting a solo flight across the Pacific. As an experienced aviator in her own right, Rabbi Bengelsdorf tells the press, the First Lady has concluded that something very like what happened to Amelia Earhart appears now to have overtaken the president. Life is not without risk, and aviation, of course, is not without risk, particularly for those like Amelia Earhart and Charles A. Lindbergh, whose daring and courage as solo aviators launched the aeronautical age in which we now live. Requests by reporters to meet with the First Lady are once again politely declined by her official spokesman, prompting Secretary Ford to demand the arrest of Rabbi Rasputin. Wednesday, October 14th, 1942. In the early evening, Mayor LaGuardia calls a press conference to point in particular to three manifestations of the sheer derangement that is threatening the nation's sanity. First, a front-page Chicago Tribune article, Dateline Berlin, reports that the 12-year-old son of President and Mrs. Lindbergh, the child believed to have been kidnapped and murdered in New Jersey in 1932, has been reunited with his father at Berchtesgaden after having been rescued by the Nazis from a dungeon in Krakow, Poland, where he had been held prisoner in the city's Jewish ghetto ever since his disappearance, and where, each year, blood was drawn from the captive boy to be used in the ritual preparation of the community's Passover matzahs. Second, House Republicans introduce a bill calling for a declaration of war against the Commonwealth of Canada should Prime Minister King fail to reveal the whereabouts of America's missing president within 48 hours. Third, law enforcement agencies in the South and Midwest report that the so-called anti-Semitic riots of October 12th were instigated by local Jewish elements working as part of a far-reaching Jewish conspiracy intent on undermining the country's morale. Of the 122 killed in the rioting, 97 have already been identified as Jewish provocateurs, seeking to deflect suspicion from the very group responsible for the disorder and plotting to take control of the federal government. Mayor LaGuardia says, "There's a plot afoot, all right, and I'll gladly name the forces propelling it. Hysteria, ignorance, malice, stupidity, hatred, and fear." What a repugnant spectacle our country has become. Falsehood, cruelty, and madness everywhere, and brute force in the wings waiting to finish us off. Now we read in the Chicago Tribune that all these years, clever Jewish bakers have been using the blood of the kidnapped Lindbergh child for making Passover matzahs in Poland. A story just as nutty today as when it was first concocted by anti-Semitic maniacs 500 years ago. How it must please the Führer to be poisoning our country with this sinister nonsense. Jewish interests, Jewish elements, Jewish usurers, Jewish retaliation, Jewish conspiracies, a Jewish war against the world. To have enslaved America with this hocus-pocus, to have captured the mind of the world's greatest nation without uttering a single word of truth. Oh, the pleasure we must be affording the most malevolent man on earth. Thursday, October 15th, 1942. Just before dawn, Rabbi Lionel Bengelsdorf is taken into custody by the FBI under suspicion of being among the ringleaders of the Jewish conspiratorial plot against America. At the same time, the First Lady, said to be suffering from extreme nervous exhaustion, is transferred by ambulance from the White House to Walter Reed Army Hospital. Others arrested in the early morning roundup include Governor Lehman, Bernard Baruch, Justice Frankfurter, Frankfurter protege and Roosevelt administrator David Lilienthal, New Deal advisors Adolf Burl and Sam Rosenman, labor leaders David Dubinsky and Sidney Hillman, economist Isidore Lubin, leftist journalists I.F. Stone and James Wexler, and socialist Louis Waldman. More arrests are said to be imminent, but the FBI has not disclosed whether the charge of conspiring to kidnap the president will be brought against any or all of the suspects. Tank and infantry units of the U.S. Army enter New York to assist the National Guard in putting down sporadic anti-government street violence. In Chicago, Philadelphia, and Boston, attempts to mount protest demonstrations against the FBI, demonstrations in violation of martial law, result only in minor injuries, though arrests numbering in the hundreds are reported by police. In Congress, leading Republicans praise the FBI for thwarting the conspirators' plot. In New York, Mayor LaGuardia is joined at a press conference by Eleanor Roosevelt and Roger Baldwin of the ACLU. They demand the immediate release of Governor Lehman, along with his alleged co-conspirators. LaGuardia is subsequently arrested at the mayor's mansion. To address an emergency protest rally convened by a New York Citizens Committee, former President Roosevelt travels from his home at Hyde Park to New York. For his own protection, he is promptly taken into custody by the police. The U.S. Army shuts down all newspaper offices and radio stations in New York, where the after-dark martial law curfew will be enforced round the clock until further notice. Tanks close off all bridges and tunnels into the city. In Buffalo, the mayor announces his intention to distribute gas masks to the city's citizens, and the mayor of nearby Rochester initiates a bomb shelter program to protect our residents in the event of a surprise Canadian attack. An exchange of small arms fire is reported by the Canadian Broadcasting Company on the border between Maine and the province of New Brunswick, not far from Roosevelt's summer home on Campobello Island in the Bay of Fundy. From London, Prime Minister Churchill warns of an imminent German invasion of Mexico, purportedly to protect America's southern flank while the United States sets about to wrest control of Canada from the British. "It is no longer a matter," says Churchill, "of the great American democracy taking military action to save us. The time has come for American citizens to take civil action to save themselves. There are not two isolated historical dramas, the American and the British, and there never were. There is only one ordeal, and now, as in the past, we face it in common." Friday, October 16th, 1942. Beginning at 9 a.m., a radio transmitter secreted somewhere in the nation's capital broadcast the voice of the First Lady, who, with the assistance of Lindbergh loyalists inside the Secret Service, has managed to escape from Walter Reed, where, alleged by authorities to be a mental patient in the care of army psychiatrists. She has been straitjacketed and held prisoner for nearly 24 hours. The tone is appealingly gentle. The words uttered without a trace of harshness or righteous contempt, altogether the evenly paced voice of someone entirely respectable who is educated to face down sorrow and disappointment without ever losing her self-restraint. She is no cyclone, yet the undertaking is extraordinary and she shows no fear. My fellow Americans, unlawfulness on the part of America's law enforcement agencies cannot and will not be allowed to prevail. In my husband's name, I ask all National Guard units to disarm and disband, and for our guardsmen to return to civilian life. I ask all members of the United States Armed Forces to leave our cities and to regroup at their home bases under the command of their authorized senior officers. I ask the FBI to release all of those arrested on charges of conspiring to harm my husband and to restore immediately their full rights as citizens. I ask law enforcement authorities throughout the nation to do the same with those who have been detained in local and state jails. There is not a shred of evidence that a single detainee is in any way responsible for whatever befell my husband and his plane on or after Wednesday, October 7th, 1942. I ask the New York City Police to vacate the illegally occupied premises of government-sequestered newspapers, magazines, and radio stations, and that these facilities resume their normal activities as guaranteed under the First Amendment to the Constitution. I ask the Congress of the United States to initiate proceedings to remove from office the current acting President of the United States and to appoint a new president in accordance with the Presidential Succession Act of 1886, which designates the Secretary of State as next in line for the presidency should the vice presidency be vacant. The Succession Act of 1886 also states that, under the circumstances described, Congress shall decide whether to call a special presidential election, and so I ask the Congress to do just that and to authorize a presidential election that will coincide with the congressional election scheduled for the first Tuesday after the first Monday of November. Her morning broadcast is repeated by the First Lady every half hour until, at noon, she announces that, in defiance of the acting president, whom she charges by name with having ordered her illegal abduction and confinement, she is returning to take up residence with her children at the White House. Deliberately appropriating for her peroration echoes of American democracy's most revered text, she concludes, "I will not yield to or be intimidated by the illegal representatives of a seditious administration, and I ask no more of the American people than that they follow my example and refuse to accept or support government conduct that is indefensible." The history of the present administration is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. This government has been deaf to the voice of justice and has extended over us an unwarrantable jurisdiction. Consequently, in defense of those same inalienable rights claimed in July of 1776 by Jefferson of Virginia and Franklin of Pennsylvania and Adams of Massachusetts Bay, and by the authority of the same good people of these United States, and appealing to the same supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, I, Anne Morrow Lindbergh, a native of the state of New Jersey, a resident of the District of Columbia, and the spouse of the 33rd President of the United States, declare that injurious history of usurpation to be ended. Our enemy's plot has failed. Liberty and justice are restored, and those who have violated the Constitution of the United States shall now be addressed by the judicial branch of government in strict keeping with the law of the land. Our Lady of the White House, as Harold Dickies grudgingly christens Mrs. Lindbergh, returns to the presidential living quarters early that evening, and from there, marshaling the power of her mystique as sorrowing mother of the martyred infant and resolute widow of the vanished god, engineers the speedy dismantling by Congress and the courts of the unconstitutional Wheeler administration, whose criminality in a mere 8 days in office, has far exceeded that of Warren Harding's Republican administration 20 years earlier. The restoration of orderly democratic procedures initiated by Mrs. Lindbergh culminates 2.5 weeks later, on Tuesday, November 3, 1942, in a sweep by the Democrats of the House and the Senate, and the landslide victory of Franklin Delano Roosevelt for a third presidential term. The next month, following the devastating surprise attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese, and 4 days later, the declaration of war on the United States by Germany and Italy, America enters the global conflict that had begun in Europe some 3 years earlier with the German invasion of Poland and had since expanded to encompass two-thirds of the world's population. Disgraced by their collusion with the acting president and demoralized by their colossal electoral defeat, the few Republicans remaining in Congress pledged their support to the Democratic president and his fight to the finish against the Axis powers. The House and the Senate approve America's going to war without a dissenting vote in either chamber. And the following day, President Roosevelt issues Proclamation No. 2568, granting a pardon to Burton Wheeler. In part, it reads, "As a result of certain acts occurring before his removal from the office of acting president, Burton K. Wheeler has become liable to possible indictment and trial for offenses against the United States. To spare the country the ordeal of such a criminal prosecution against a former acting president of the United States, and to protect against the disruptive distraction of such a spectacle during a time of war, I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Burton Wheeler for all offenses against the United States, which he, Burton Wheeler, has committed or may have committed, or taken part in during the period from October 8, 1942, through October 16, 1942. As everyone knows, President Lindbergh was not found or heard from again. Those stories circulated throughout the war, and for a decade afterward, along with the rumors about other prominent missing persons of that turbulent era, like Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary who was thought to have eluded the Allied armies by escaping to Juan Perón's Argentina, but who more likely perished during the last days of Nazi Berlin, and Raoul Wallenberg, the Swedish diplomat whose distribution of Swedish passports saved some 20,000 Hungarian Jews from extermination by the Nazis, although he himself disappeared, probably into a Soviet jail when the Russians occupied Budapest in 1945. Among the dwindling number of Lindbergh conspiracy scholars, reports on clues and sightings have continued to appear in intermittently published newsletters devoted to speculation on the unexplained fate of America's 33rd president. The most elaborate story, the most unbelievable story, though not necessarily the least convincing, was first made known to our family by Aunt Evelyn after Rabbi Bengelsdorf's arrest. Her source? None other than Anne Morrow Lindbergh, who allegedly confided the details to the rabbi just days before the First Lady was removed from the White House against her will and held prisoner in the psychiatric wing of Walter Reed. Mrs. Lindbergh, reported Rabbi Bengelsdorf, traced everything to the 1932 kidnapping of her infant son Charles, secretly plotted and financed, she maintained, by the Nazi Party shortly before Hitler came to power. According to the rabbi's recapitulation of the First Lady's story, the baby had been passed on for safekeeping by Bruno Hauptmann to a friend living near him in the Bronx, a fellow German immigrant who in actuality was a Nazi espionage agent. And only hours after having been lifted from the Hopewell, New Jersey crib and carried down the makeshift ladder in Hauptmann's arms, Charles Jr. had already been smuggled out of the country and was en route to Germany. The corpse found and identified as the Lindbergh baby 10 weeks later was another child selected by the Nazis to be murdered because of its resemblance to the Lindbergh baby and then, when the body was already decomposing, planted in the woods near the Lindbergh home to ensure Hauptmann's conviction and execution and to keep secret the true circumstances of the kidnapping from everyone but the Lindberghs themselves. Through a Nazi spy stationed as a foreign news correspondent in New York, the couple had been informed early on of Charles's arrival healthy and unharmed on German soil and assured that the best of care would be provided him by a specially selected team of Nazi doctors, nurses, teachers, and military personnel. Care merited by his status as firstborn son of the world's greatest aviator, provided that the Lindberghs cooperated fully with Berlin. As a result of this threat, for the next 10 years, the lot of the Lindberghs and their kidnapped child, and gradually the destiny of the United States of America, was determined by Adolf Hitler. Through the skill and efficiency of his agents in New York and Washington, and in London and Paris, after the celebrated couple complying with orders, fled to live as expatriates in Europe, where Lindbergh began regularly to visit Nazi Germany and extol the achievements of its military machine, the Nazis set about to exploit Lindbergh's fame in behalf of the Third Reich and at the expense of America, dictating where the couple would reside, whom they would befriend, and above all, what opinions they would espouse in their public utterances and published writings. In 1938, as a reward for Lindbergh's graciously accepting a prestigious medal from Hermann Göring at a Berlin dinner in the Aviator's honor, and after numerous pleading letters that were secretly channeled from Anne Morrow Lindbergh to the Fuhrer himself, the Lindberghs were at last allowed to visit their child. By then, a handsome, fair-haired boy of almost eight who, from the day he arrived in Germany, had been raised as a model Hitler youth. The German-speaking cadet did not understand, nor was he told, that the famous Americans, to whom he and his classmates were introduced following parade exercises at their elite military academy, were his mother and father. Nor were the Lindberghs permitted to speak to him, or to be photographed with him. The visit came at just the moment when Anne Morrow Lindbergh had concluded that the Nazis' kidnapping story was an unspeakably cruel hoax, and that the time was long overdue for the Lindberghs to free themselves from the bondage to Adolf Hitler. Instead, after seeing Charles alive for the first time since his disappearance in 1932, the Lindberghs left Germany irreversibly in thrall to their country's worst enemy. They were ordered to end their expatriation and return to America, where Colonel Lindbergh was to take up the cause of America First. Speeches were provided, written in English, denouncing the British, Roosevelt, and the Jews, and supporting America's neutrality in the European war. Detailed instructions specified where and when speeches were to be delivered, even the type of apparel to be donned for each public appearance. Every political stratagem originating in Berlin, Lindbergh enacted with the same meticulous perfectionism that distinguished his aeronautical pursuits, right down to the night that he arrived in aviator attire at the Republican Convention and accepted the nomination for the presidency, with words written for the occasion by Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels. The Nazis plotted every maneuver of the election campaign that followed, and once Lindbergh had defeated FDR, it was Hitler himself who took charge, proceeding to prepare, in weekly meetings with Goering, his designated successor and director of the German economy, and Heinrich Himmler, overlord of Germany's internal affairs and chief of the Gestapo, the police agency charged with Charles Lindbergh Jr.'s custody. A foreign policy for the United States that would best serve Germany's wartime objectives and his grand imperial design. Soon, Himmler began to interfere directly in U.S. domestic affairs by bringing pressure on President Lindbergh, humorously belittled in the Gestapo chief's memos as our American Gauleiter, to institute repressive measures against the 4.5 million American Jews. And it was here, according to Mrs. Lindbergh, that the president undertook, if only passively at the start, to assert his resistance. To begin with, he ordered the establishment of the Office of American Absorption, in his judgment, an agency inconsequential enough to leave the Jews essentially unharmed while seemingly meeting with token programs like Just Folks and Homestead 42, Himmler's directive to inaugurate in America a systematic process of marginalization that will lead in the foreseeable future to the confiscation of all Jewish wealth and the total disappearance of the Jewish population, their appurtenances, and their property.